Welcome to the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. And there's lots to cover this week. Theresa May gave her long-awaited speech where she announced just exactly what Brexit meant to her. And we'll be talking about that and some of the polling around single market membership and immigration. We'll also be talking about her personal approval ratings and how they may have changed over time and what that means for Britain politically. And finally, we'll be talking about the NHS and recent polling around that subject and what that means for Westminster politics. And later in the show, we'll be talking about the very small issue of Donald Trump's inauguration as President of the United States. I'll be joined by White House commentator John Christopher Buer, who has joined us several times on this podcast, and will give his thoughts as to what we might expect from the Donald as he becomes president. Even now, it still seems surprising to say. But before we get on to that, and that will be later, I'm joined by Adam Drummond of Opinion. Adam, welcome. We're going to be talking a bit about the numbers.
Thanks, Kieran.
So let's crack on. I mean, before we get into the nitty-gritty of it, I guess, well, what was your reaction to Theresa May's speech? The public seemed to be relatively favourable. I was looking at some Sky Data polling, which said 51% suggested that they supported Britain leaving the single market, and 51% also said they trusted Theresa May to get the best possible Brexit deal. So it certainly felt like a successful speech.
I think the PR and the optics around it have certainly been very good for the Prime Minister. What I find quite interesting is that it's being treated as if any of this was really new information, because if you've paid attention to really any of Theresa May's public pronouncements since she became Prime Minister, it's been quite obvious that, you know, hard Brexit, leaving the single market has been, you know, on the cards for quite a while. Ever since it became clear that Theresa May has interpreted the referendum result as being a vote to restrict immigration and has made that sort of her red line, it's been pretty clear that, especially given the unity of the other EU members around single market access being conditional on accepting free movement, it's been pretty clear that that single market membership would have to go in order to meet that immigration requirement.
But it was good. I think that from her perspective, it was quite a strong day yesterday, because there was just clarity finally. I mean, some people are still trying to suggest that it's not clear that she has a plan or what her plan is. But I think as I said on social media last night, if the biggest criticism she has coming away from this speech is, well, you can't control everything from now on, well, she's done pretty well to date, hasn't she? Because she hasn't tried to fudge the idea or to play the card that she thinks she can get single market access and restrictions of free movement. She's been very clear, this is what I want. And that I think is why the reaction from EU leaders, granted a lot of them are in Davos at the moment, was fairly muted, right? I mean, there wasn't any sort of gotcha moment. She's very clear on what she wants, and I guess now we have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, and I think it's quite interesting, again, just this idea of, you know, the Overton window of, you know, what is within the mainstream of debate and how much that has shifted since the referendum, and certainly since before the referendum. If you remember back in sort of last summer, a lot of the discussion was around how we can get the benefits of single market access while being able to restrict the levels of immigration, and how, you know, impossible that was. And the message coming out from Donald Tusk and the other sort of EU leaders was that no single market membership unless you accept freedom of movement. So it's quite interesting that rather than take that as, you know, in any kind of any sense a sort of strategic defeat, she's sort of turned that on its head, and it's now seen as, no, this is what our demand, this is what we're, what, you know, the plan is. So in a sense, taking what from a PR perspective, certainly taking what is otherwise quite a sort of weak hand or weak perspective, she's taken what is otherwise a disadvantage and in you know, publicity terms at least converted that into a strength.
She's got lots of support in the media, hasn't she? I mean, that Daily Mail front page was something to behold. I don't know whether listeners have seen it, but they should. And, you know, I as someone who's kind of relatively an agnostic Remainer, if you like, I don't sort of break out in hives at the prospect of leaving the European Union, but I did find that front page slightly strange, because I don't know, like one of the phrases was around how she's shown David Cameron how to negotiate, without paraphrasing, which was an odd thing to say when the negotiation hasn't happened yet. But I am interested, Adam, looking forward, about what the reaction might be in the polling, right? Because there's been a number of polls around hard Brexit versus soft Brexit. Indeed, Polling Matters and Opinion did one in December, and it showed a kind of narrow margin for our definition at the time of a softer Brexit. But then I'm looking at a poll conducted recently by YouGov, which listeners may or may not have seen, which asks what kind of Brexit the public wants. So which of these kind of Brexit scenarios come closest to what you personally would like to see? And I'll try and get through it as quickly as possible, but there's a sort of hard Brexit of regaining full control over how Britain is governed and who can live here, even if that means not having a free trade deal, a free trade relationship with the EU, sorry. There's getting, and then there's two versions of a soft Brexit, getting the best possible trading links with the remaining EU countries once we leave, even if that means still following some EU rules and giving up some controls of our borders, alongside trying to remain as close to the EU as possible and seeking some form of associate membership. So those are two different versions of what I guess you might call a soft Brexit. And then there's basically no Brexit, so trying to get Britain to remain in the EU after all, and then there's not sure. So I guess it's difficult over sort of audio, but think of it in sort of four different choices, really. Hard Brexit, 39% chose that. Soft Brexit, 25% chose that, and that was obviously split into the two versions I mentioned. And then remaining, after all, 23% chose that. 13% said not sure. And this was positioned as a preference for a hard Brexit, because hard Brexit was 39, soft Brexit was 25. But I think a theme of today that I'm going to invite listeners to sort of partake in is to be very careful about how these numbers are crunched and how you interpret them, particularly when you're not really paying attention to the detail. That is, after all, what this podcast is supposed to be about. Because if you take soft Brexit, 25%, and add it to remain, 23%, then you get, what was that, 48%. yeah, coincidentally. Versus, you know, hard Brexit of 39. So I get, I'm not here to pass judgment on which is the correct course of action and that sort of thing, but the point is that the same numbers can show the public preferring a hard Brexit to a soft Brexit, but they can also show people preferring, you know, a soft Brexit slash Remain, and therefore presumably Remain is a, isn't Brexit at all, so presumably those Remainers would prefer a soft Brexit if they were made to choose. So it's a confusing picture, I think, and it sort of depends on how you want to look at the numbers, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think obviously with polls, that was a huge amount, depends on how you ask the question, and that's obviously something to bear in mind when you look at the results. So as you said, you've got that 39% for what we call the hard Brexit option, which is, you know, a plurality of the options there, but you have to assume that most of the 23% who say, no, we actually want to stay in the EU, you have to assume that most of them are going to go for one or two of the soft Brexit options rather than the full hard Brexit. Having said that, though, again, it's a poll. They're presented with multiple options. If it comes down to a binary choice between, say, you know, stay in the single market and leave the single market, it's difficult to put too much weight on assumptions that everyone will go the way you expect them to. I mean, the point of view that I suppose I've been coming around to, so I was a Remain supporter, but I've almost been coming around to the view that it's best to either have complete engagement or complete disengagement rather than perhaps some sort of a fudge where you try and get the best of both but actually end up with perhaps the worst of both.
Well, unless you think that the fudge, so to speak, is the best thing for the country, right? So unless you think that, well, the economy is going to be sufficiently to the detriment of the economy, a hard Brexit, that any form of soft Brexit is better than...
Yeah, and that's a very important consideration. So, again, if we... thinking about the options that people in polls are presented with, yeah, it's reasonably fair to assume that most of the 23% there who said that trying to remain in the EU was what they wanted out of Brexit, it's fairly reasonable to assume that if that option hadn't been there, they would have chosen one of the two softer Brexit options to keep closer ties with the EU. But the whole question of what's more important, control over freedom of movement or the economic benefits of single market access, in all the polling that we've done since the referendum, in fact, even before the referendum, it's been almost as divided as the referendum result itself. In fact, only in the last poll that we did, so around about the 10th of January, did we start to see higher figures for controlling immigration over staying in the single market. And I think there's certainly one of the possible causes for that is the fact that if you think about the public debate and who's making which points and which arguments, there's no real sort of leader on the pro-European side. Nobody's really making the case for staying in the single market and the benefits of that versus the risks of leaving it. Whereas on the other side, you have a fairly unified sort of newspaper position, certainly among the more right-wing newspapers, that no, hard Brexit or clean Brexit, as it's starting to be termed, is the be-all and end-all, and that must be what happens.
And as I'm looking at some of the cross-breaks here of this same polling question, it kind of sort of supports what you're saying. So 74% of Leave voters back the YouGov's version of a hard Brexit. Although I suppose there is an interesting way of interpreting this because, well, I'm not sure what the exact numbers are because it's not clear from the chart, but there's at least 12% backing a soft Brexit of Leave voters. So I suppose when you factor that into the 52-48 split, I don't know, it becomes confusing. But I guess it's, look, the overwhelming majority of Leave voters support the idea of a hard Brexit. When you look at Remain voters, it's pretty different, isn't it?
So equally, the overwhelming majority of Remain voters either want to stay in the EU after all. Again, coincidentally, it seems to be 48% of Remain voters want to stay in the EU after all. And then 17% choose each of the different soft Brexit options. So the two sides are fairly sort of evenly divided in that respect.
Well, they are and they aren't, right? Because, I mean, yes, it's true that only 9% of Remain voters want a hard Brexit, but then there's no consensus about what they actually want, right?
No.
Because it's either Remain or soft Brexit. I mean, there's a confusion there.
And again, that comes down to the difficulty of, I suppose, of a poll question which has multiple options, and we don't know what the exact split would be if you only presented a binary choice, which, of course, is what we have with the referendum.
Let's talk a bit about immigration, because as you sort of alluded to a moment ago, that one of the sort of key considerations or apparent trade-offs that seem to be being made here is this idea of single market access versus freedom of movement. Again, YouGov, it won't all be YouGov today, but they also had a question looking at immigration recently, about a week or so ago, and it asked people essentially whether they wanted, which of the following best reflects your views of immigration into Britain. And I won't read out all of the choices, but essentially people were left with the choice of they wanted immigration relaxed or tightened or kept about the same. And the rough split was just 6% said they wanted immigration rules relaxed, 16% said they wanted immigration rules to remain as they are, and 69% said that they wanted immigration to be tightened, either a little or a lot. And this transcends, every conceivable demographic. Only sort of 12% of Labour voters wanted immigration to be relaxed. And
58% of Lib Dem voters want to see immigration controls tightened.
So, I mean, it's an overwhelming, I guess it goes to show where public opinion is on this issue. At the same time, just going back to the theme I mentioned earlier, there is something of an issue here about how you sort of split the numbers. So on face value, 69% of Brits want immigration rules tightened. And I don't think anybody would disagree that that's true. But if you take the number that say they would like immigration rules to be tightened a lot, which is 40% of the public, and you compare that to people that would either want immigration rules to stay the same or be tightened a little, that's 45% of the public. And I guess all I'm saying here is I'm not trying to argue that immigration is somehow not a significant issue in British politics. That would be a stupid thing to say. But actually, there is a kind of sizable body of opinion that says, well, it's like kind of okay as it is, or I want it tightened a bit. And that's very different to, for example, UKIP voters, 84% of which want immigration rules to be tightened a lot. So it's a confusing picture, again, for public policy decision makers, isn't it?
And I think nobody's more confused than the one UKIP voter in this poll who wants immigration rules to be relaxed quite a lot. But I think it's certainly an interesting point about how numbers are interpreted and how perhaps the most extreme version of a particular position is often presented as being more mainstream. Because as you said, 45% or so want immigration rules to either remain as they are or to be tightened a little. And the exact words are tightened a little. So you could quite easily present that as being 40% want a strict immigration clampdown, 45% back a more moderate position. So one of the things that we, whenever we do polling about issues and what are the most important issues facing the country, we always try and include a question about what are the most important issues facing the country and also also what are the most important issues facing you, you know, your household, your family. And one of the things that always comes up is that health, the NHS, are always quite important in both questions. The economy is always quite important in both questions. Immigration is always much more important nationally than it is to you and your family. So it's very much seen as something which you know, affects the country, but is not seen as something which affects, you know, the individual, the household level as much. So I think the salience issue here is quite important.
Very important. And I guess, I mean, you know, in some ways, some of these nuances are moot points, because Theresa May clearly is going to go for that hard Brexit, and to use that phrase, and she seems unstoppable, and therefore, you know, maybe the nuance of the debate is almost irrelevant in that case. On that note, let's look at Theresa May. You've been looking at some of her approval ratings with Opinium, haven't you? And I just wanted to get your perspective, really, on what you kind of, what your sense of her political situation is.
So I think compared to various other polls that come out, I think we tend to show slightly smaller Conservative leads at the moment. But even then, we have Theresa May's approval rating at 40% versus 29% who disapprove. So by comparison, the kind of figures that we were getting for David Cameron when we started polling on him, he never had that much of a lead for his approval rating, for his approval figures over his disapproval figures. I think the best he started to do was around about even money on both sides around about the time when he won the election. So Theresa May's got very good approval ratings, certainly compared to her various rivals. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is quite deep underwater, 21% approve, 48% disapprove. Tim Farron is well, his numbers are lower overall because fewer people know who he is or have an opinion on him. So 17% approve, 31% disapprove. Paul Nuttall is even lower still. Again, not that well known a figure, certainly compared to Nigel Farage. But the crossbreaks that I tend to look at for Theresa May's ratings are what Remain voters and Leave voters think of her. So back in back when she'd first become Prime Minister, so during that sort of summer honeymoon, and certainly before the Conservative conference, both Remain voters and Leave voters could, in theory, sort of project their idealized version of a Brexit plan onto her, and give her the benefit of the doubt there. So as a result, you saw quite positive ratings. Okay, more from Leave voters, but still very positive positive ratings for Theresa May among Remain voters as well. The picture we get now, as you might expect, given that she's chosen a very particular course, is that Remain voters have soured on her quite a bit. So her figures among Leave voters are 48% approve, 22% disapprove. Her figures among Remain voters are around about 36-37% approve and disapprove. So to an extent, though, that's a testament to how popular she still is. So even among Remain voters, you know, who whose, you know, concerns about Europe, she is essentially sort of dismissing by going ahead with this hard
course. Possibly the Tory Remainers, maybe?
Perhaps, yes. So even they are not, you know, turning against her completely. They're still fairly sort of evenly split on her.
I mean, one of the things that it's always struck me is that she very much knows where her so-called political bread is buttered. I think there was a poll I saw by YouGov when I was looking at the crossbreaks of the 2015 voters, and what it showed was that one in five UKIP voters from 2015 now say that they're voting Conservative, which was, you know, a decent chunk of people when you consider that UKIP still managed to poll in the sort of low teens or thereabouts. She kind of has clearly decided that the Conservatives are going to be the party of Brexit, and come what may, pardon the pun. And, you know, that's clearly gives her a very strong electoral coalition for the future. But I suppose it also does box her in. So if these things don't go very well, who knows what comes next?
It's hard to forecast that too much. So as you said, she very much knows, where bread is buttered. And therefore, I think, you know, not unimportant factors here are the fact that a majority of Tory voters back Leave, a vast majority of Tory members back Leave. Even though MPs themselves were, I think, narrowly in favour of Remain, the pressure is quite clearly, you know, all coming to her from the more Eurosceptic, more, you know, pro-Leave end of things. So it's not really surprising that she's, decided that that's the group to appeal to. just because I'm endlessly plugging this, but the Political Tribes work that Opinium did.
Did you do Political Tribes work?
I may have mentioned this before, yeah. So the thing that was most striking about that was that it really clearly sort of highlighted which group May was going after. So we had the more sort of Tory loyalist group, and then we had this group who were a fairly sizable sort of quarter of the electorate, who were almost evenly split between UKIP and the Tories. So they're very much the sort of UKIP-y end of the Tory party. And everything that the Prime Minister's done since we looked at that set of numbers has given the impression that that's basically the group she's going after. And everything seems designed to appeal to that group, and it's paying off.
Yeah. Let's finish with some talk about the NHS and healthcare, which it's obviously been sort of knocked off the agenda with Theresa May's speech, but certainly, and I think rightly so, without editorialising too much, has been sort of really making the headlines in the recent past. So there's been a lot of numbers. There's been a lot of numbers out there on the NHS and who do you trust and how important the issue is. And I'm just going to fire through some of them, and then maybe we can get your thoughts on it. So we've got the clear difference here seems to be that when I think YouGov ask which party do you trust the most on the NHS, Labour beats the Conservatives by 28-20, and yet when we look at ComRes numbers. Despite the fact that 53% think Jeremy Hunt is doing a bad job as the health secretary, when asked who would do a better job at managing the NHS this winter, Theresa May and the Tories got 43% of respondents' approval, and Jeremy Corbyn and Labour 31%, and that was ComRes last weekend. So basically what it shows is that Labour as a political party, as a brand, is trusted more than the Tories on the NHS. But when you add Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn's names in there, that's different.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty remarkable, actually. I know the question got a little bit of criticism because it was presented as being the Tories are ahead of Labour on the NHS without adding the nuance that it's talking about leaders. But then in an actual election campaign, the leaders are going to be extremely prominent. That is what's going to be, you know, top of people's mind when they think about it. So I think it's a very sort of fair way of looking at it. And it's just pretty astonishing that, you know, this is Labour's area. This is where they should be miles ahead, even in their worst moments, even when, you know, David Cameron was 30 points ahead of Gordon Brown or whatever the figures were, Labour was still ahead on the NHS. So it's pretty remarkable that, especially given that, you know, concern about the NHS has risen, especially in the last couple of weeks in polls. I think in the YouGov one that got mentioned, it's risen by about 10 points in the poll that we did. I think it was first. The fact that Labour, in theory, should be making hay out of this, they should be making a huge amount of progress on this, but the leader issue is holding them back.
Jeremy Corbyn doesn't do progress for a number of reasons.
Yes.
Horrific political pun there. Certainly very true. I mean, give Jeremy Corbyn some good news. I mean, is there any encouragement for Labour? I mean, I think one of the things I've noticed, I have this theory on this idea of a Labour floor, that it's not necessarily as bad as people are making out. In the context that if you think a 12-point general election defeat or thereabouts is not, that's not something to worry about. Of course it is. But I think a lot of people get quite sensational about saying, well, Labour's going to get 20 in the polls or it's going to get lower and all this. I don't quite buy that. I see in a lot of these polls, whether it's VI, voting attention, or like leader approvals, a lot of Labour voters say they don't know, which means that they end up getting excluded from voting intention polls. Or it ends up being that, like, you know, Jeremy Corbyn versus Theresa May in a horse race has a large chunk of don't knows in there too. And I suppose the question is really going to be, when it comes to it, will those people return to the Labour fold? And I guess we can't know that for sure. But I do think that in the numbers, there is some room for Labour's vote to grow. I don't see how you can win a general election from there. But it certainly seems that actually, you know, if Labour voters do come home, it shouldn't be the disaster that people think. But what's your take?
So I think the biggest positive for Labour at the moment is that they're not really in danger of being replaced as the second party, because even if politics is splitting along Leave Remain lines, which I'm not convinced it is, one of the main features is that you have two clear parties for Leave, which are the Tories and UKIP, and for the Remain side, you've got the Lib Dems, who are still to an extent tainted by their sort of experience of coalition, their current sort of low teens, high single figures poll rating is nowhere near the sort of 20% plus that they were getting in elections before a coalition. So Labour's position as the second largest party seems fairly secure, at least, even if there is an absolutely, from their perspective, calamitous 12-point loss. The other thing about Jeremy Corbyn specifically, though, is that his approval ratings, especially among Labour voters, are not that much worse than Ed Miliband had throughout most of the last parliament. Now, obviously, Ed Miliband went on to lose quite badly and resigned, and one of the figures that really should have given away the fact that the VI numbers were a little bit misleading there was the fact that David Cameron had a huge lead over him as best prime minister, albeit not as large as the lead that Theresa May has over Jeremy Corbyn. But it does suggest that, again, the possible floor for how badly Labour is going to do might not be that much worse than in 2015.
Mm. Certainly one to keep an eye out for. Maybe we should be looking at leaders' approval ratings and horse races on who makes the best prime minister more than the voting intention itself, or at least taking it as seriously. That's all we've got time for this section of this week's podcast. Big thanks to Adam Drummond of Opinion for his take on things. The next part of the episode is going to be me talking to White House correspondent and sort of US political expert John Christopher Buer. Backed by popular demand, I've had several people ask about JC and his views on things, particularly as we approach the inauguration on Friday. So what you're about to hear is my conversation with John Christopher earlier today, where we talked about his views on the upcoming inauguration and what to expect next. John Christopher Buer, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you on again.
It's a great to be on with you, Garen, and what a time we're living in right now.
Certainly is. So the day is almost finally here, Inauguration Day on Friday. I must admit, I was saying to my wife, it's going to feel strange, actually, when he actually is president, because it feels like we've been waiting for this moment through the transition for so long. But I just wanted to start a conversation, really, by getting your impressions of the inauguration and what you're feeling, because it feels to me that in 2008, when Barack Obama was made president, there was an era of sort of celebration, or it certainly felt that way, whereas now it feels there's more trepidation. But maybe I've got that wrong. I mean, what's your impressions being over there and sort of talking to people?
Well, it's the first president in modern times whose approval rating is very low. In fact, it's way under 40%. If even that, Obama was about almost 70% approval rating when he was taking his oath of office, and Trump has managed to create these great expectations, and people now, even those who were really really behind him, are looking and saying, wait a minute, did we really vote for a man who says he's going to fix healthcare like that? No response, no plan, no policy. He's going to take care of it. Do we really elect a president who is going to have a reset with Russia and cozy up to Mr. Putin? We didn't vote for that. What are we going to do after he takes the oath of office and marches down the street to the White House and gets behind that Oval Office desk on Friday, but he says he's really not going to do much work on Friday or Saturday. He's going to start in on Monday. I don't think this man, who's spending still an enormous amount of time in New York, costing the New York City residents over $3 million a day just in securing that Trump Tower, I don't know if he really knows what's up for him when he takes this job. It's not a fun job. It's not a powerful job. Many people think it's the most powerful job. It's not. You have to listen to everybody. You need Congress to do anything. And he's a CEO, but he's not a CEO anymore. He's a president, which means he has to preside and bring along 535 individuals from the Congress to go along with him, or he doesn't get whatever his agenda is through. Mm. So we shall see that when the parades are done and when the bands have finished playing, he's going to sit there alone behind his Oval Office desk and say, okay, this is what I have to do now. And when those presidential daily briefings come in about what's going on in the world and what's going on with the threats of the world, which will come fast and furious, he has to make decisions, and he has to call on his allies. And you can't insult your allies, and you can't insult your members of Congress, and he certainly has done that with the people he ran against, the Republican in the primary. He's got to pull it all together. And this, as you said, this has to be a healing moment, a reconciliation moment, an embracing moment. And I don't think this is what Mr. Trump is even considering. So, you know, we'll give him the benefit. You know, he's got some issues. He's from Queens, New York, like I am. So you never feel you're good enough or strong enough or smart enough. That's why he's so verbose, and he says the biggest, the greatest. And maybe that Queens thing, that Queens inferiority syndrome, as I call it, maybe it'll come through for him, and he'll want to be better and survive. He doesn't want to be a failure, I can tell you that.
And he also does enter office with a lot going for him, doesn't he? Where he has both houses of Congress, and so in theory, he should be able to get his agenda through, don't you think? I mean, what's your interpretation of his potential relationship with Congress? Because that's going to be really important to how he does, isn't it?
Well, I don't think. Well, first of all, a few members of Congress aren't showing up to his inaugural, and that doesn't bode well for him. There will be more protesters in this town than supporters. The defense concept of protection of the individuals is higher than ever. I mean, the Homeland Security, et cetera, the Secret Service, the FBI, the military is the biggest force you will ever see. And there are scores and scores and scores of protest applications all over the town. In fact, one man tried to set himself afire in front of the Trump Tower. Here, the Trump Hotel, here on Pennsylvania Avenue last night.
Oh, wow.
As I was driving by, I was wondering what the hell that was. And, you know, it's like Buddhist monks during the Vietnam War, before the Vietnam War, I mean, self-immolating. It's really, the answer to your question directly is, we don't know what his policies are. You know, we really don't understand what his policies are. And you're telling me, clearly, would seem logical, well, he's got both houses of Congress, and he's a Republican, he can get things done. But what are the things he wants to get done? That's the question.
Mm. And one of the things I noticed with a sort of wry smile was that some of the polling suggests that Obamacare is as popular as it's ever been. And I don't know if you saw it, but there was a town hall meeting where Paul Ryan was giving a speech, and there was a gentleman in the crowd who was a Republican. I think he might have even worked on the George H.W. Bush campaign and the Ronald Reagan campaigns, so a long-time Republican, and he said Obamacare saved his life. So I guess repealing and replacing Obamacare is going to be a big part of whether he's perceived to be a success or a failure, isn't it?
Well, like everything else, he said it's done. He's got his plan. You know, he knows what he's going to do, and he's going to be done. You can't be flip and just say that. There are so many millions of people who, depending on the Affordable Care Act, I'm not crazy about it, every aspect of it. I don't think we have a good system here. I know you don't have a terribly good one there at the moment of health care. And I think the fact that the insurance companies and big pharmaceuticals are dictating how we aid and help our sick and those who we want to prevent from being ill is the wrong way to go. Bernie Sanders, you know, believed in the single payer. In other words, sort of like Medicare and Medicaid. Just that's how it goes. The government, it goes through the government. But we don't do that. We won't have that, and it'll never be voted in. So we've got a real problem. And I don't know what he's planning to do.
I mean, moving towards foreign policy, obviously, over here in Europe, lots of turmoil with the Brexit vote and lots of sort of insecurity vis-a-vis Vladimir Putin. What do you think Europeans should be thinking of Donald Trump? Because there's lots of different opinions around. On the one hand, Eastern Europeans, I suspect, are quite worried about NATO and the future of that alliance and what that means for them. But there are some people on the Brexit side, Leave campaigners, if you will, who have been successful there, who think Donald Trump might be good for Britain because he might help Britain get a better deal from the European Union and maybe a good trade deal for the United States. I mean, what's your perspective on his attitudes to Europe?
Well, I think the fact that he's has cozied up to Mr. Putin, and there's a lot of questions there that will be answered over the next few months or so. The fact that many of our intelligence community has really come out and said that that the Russians have in fact were involved in our election, and then he basically trashed them. You have to wonder, if you go after the intelligence community, those are the people who are giving you the information that you need to keep the enemies away, whether it's Putin or Kim Jong-un or any of the other forces in the world that are harmful to the United Kingdom, Europe, and all of our allies. One wonders, where does he stand on these things? You just don't trash the intelligence community. And many of the members of the intelligence community can't believe what Trump was doing and saying. And many believe that Putin was involved in our election, that he changed the concept, or he changed the actual way the American people voted by influencing them and by manipulating things. And by the various leaks that have come out and exposing that and giving it to the Russians, it's been a very, very difficult personal for many citizens. I don't think this country has been this desperate, this pulled apart since Abraham Lincoln soothed us after the Civil War, when we all came together. Mm. And I think that the Europeans should be very wary of where the policy of this country is going to go in the next few years.
Because one of the things I struggle to work out is through Donald Trump's rhetoric, which at times can be contradictory. I don't think that's a biased statement to make. I mean, he seems to suggest he wants to bomb ISIS and take out ISIS and that sort of thing, but also he talks about America first. So it's quite hard to tell whether he's going to be a sort of interventionist and quite active president in terms of foreign policy, or whether he's going to be more isolationist. I mean, do you have any feeling on that?
Well, I've written about this for a while. At least a year ago, I wrote that you can't want to build up the military and then say, but we're isolationist, America first. Either you're engaged or you're not engaged. Either you want to support the efforts of our allies and NATO, certainly an organization that has been extremely successful since World War II, and just say, well, we don't know, that's old time, that's old hat, that doesn't work. You just don't use those kind of glib phrases, because Putin is like the big bad wolf of the fairy tale. He's licking his chops, and he's thinking, where am I going next? Crimea, I've got that. Eastern Ukraine, I'm getting a warm water port in Syria, because my little Putin Tate there, Assad, is my boy, and no one's bothering me or touching me because they're all afraid of me. Well, he's got the bomb, that's always an issue. You can have your followers just look at Stanley Kubrick's film, Dr. Strangelove. Bring that one back up again. We're in difficult times, and the fact is that Putin is loving this, and he has never never not taken an opportunity to take advantage of a bad opportunity. Mm. I think that's what we're afraid of here, and we think the Russian reset is not what Donald Trump ran on. So he should spend his time, helping people get jobs like he promised. Let's see what he can do. As we say in New York, put your money where your mouth is.
I mean, final couple of questions before we leave you. I mean, let's talk about the Democrats. you know, where do they go from here? I think we were talking off air and you were suggesting that they don't have a very stacked bench, do they, of candidates that may wish to run against the Donald in 4 years' time. So it's going to be interesting to see how they respond to the defeat, particularly those supporters of Bernie Sanders who were so passionately in his corner and feel let down by the DNC.
Well, the problem for the Democrats is they can't lose faith and they can't lose hope. And you'll see today, President Obama is doing his last press conference, which I'll be there, and he'll be talking about keeping the faith and keeping the concept of America and its freedoms and the positiveness about America. And he'll be talking about the things that he's done. He's going to try to go out on a very positive note. But the fact is that we can't lose young people. We can't lose the millennials. After the morning after the election night, I did a two-camera piece on the White House lawn in the rain, and then I went up and picked up my old friend and Sky News colleague Adam Bolton, and we came to speak. He came to speak to my class, where I'm a professor at Catholic University of America, and when Adam came to address the young people there, they were despondent. Many were crying because they felt, you know, well, I couldn't have Bernie. A lot of them were for Bernie. I'm talking about 19, 20-year-old undergrads. And Adam and I were talking about the positiveness, being involved, staying involved. It's your country. Why don't you all get involved in politics? I have students that would be wonderful in elected office, so smart and so terrific. I think if we lose the youth and we lose the power of the positiveness that we all have, as you know, the Yank spirit of we can do great things, and I don't mean just words by a showman, I mean truly wonderful things. We can't lose that. We have to keep that. Mm. And Americans, and especially the young people, must stay engaged. And President Obama is going to be talking about that today in his press conference.
I guess it's going to be important to their future electoral chances, whether they do. I mean, final question from me, JC. How do you think America will view President Obama's presidency? I mean, he's been a two-term president, the first African-American president, of course, so his position in history, not that he would want to only be remembered for that, but his position in history is secure. But how do you think people in the future will actually assess the success of his presidency?
Well, I think the people now find him a very positive force. The piece is extremely likable, and his wife Michelle Obama, another positive force. They're very likable people. In fact, they're moving four blocks from here, where I am living. So it's going to be an interesting neighborhood. We've got Ivanka Trump, and around the corner we've got the Obamas. So the security in my neighborhood is going to be absolutely insane. It's called Colorama. Beautiful view, if you have a view, with all the Secret Service. But I think he is already being thought of as a in some ways a successful president, and in some ways half a failed president. His foreign policy. He inherited two wars, so that's a tough one. But then his inability to act, and Great Britain is involved in this as well, in Syria, I think it was about in 2013, has really caused a problem. And it's caused a problem with the refugees, and it's caused a problem with the immigrants in going all through Europe, coming up through the Balkans, and it's affected the entire world economy, especially in Western Europe. That's a problem that he'll have. Okay, so he opened up Cuba. Okay, not great. Guantanamo is still open. He hasn't closed that. He did do a remarkable thing in the beginning when he helped with the auto markets, etc., and really helped the economy right off the bat. It was in such bad shape in 2007, 2008. And that I think he'll get real credit for that, the whole kind of bailing out of the economic crisis that we were in, almost in the depression. He'll get credit for that, and he will, of course, be the first African American president, which was a real change for America. I mean, he won the Nobel Prize before he was basically in office very long, and I think because people had so much hope in him, they thought, well, let's give him the Nobel Prize now, and he'll fill the shoes. it's a really tough thing to follow. But I think partly is because they couldn't believe, perhaps, that America would ever elect an African-American with our history, with our civil rights issues. And I think that was a positive step. Now, has he been able to fulfill all of that, and has he taken the country further? Historians will be the ones on that. And we need to always remember that we need to always look at history and in the big picture, compare and have hope, because we've got the guy being sworn in 2 days who is not that kind of a positive force. And we're going to have rain that day, too, so it may rain on Donald's
parade. Rain on his parade. They say that each president that takes office is an opposite of the one before. So we had George W. Bush, and followed by Obama, who was very different. And then now we've got Donald Trump following Obama. So I guess the best way to think of it, JC, is we can only imagine who will follow Trump. But we always appreciate your time and your insight into things over there across the pond. So thanks very much for being with us today, JC.
It's a pleasure always. Thank you so much. Good luck to all of us.
Well, that was John Christopher Buer. A big thanks once again for his sort of continued support of the podcast and for taking the time to give us his opinions on things. Certainly cutting a very somber figure, I think it's fair to say today. But it will be fascinating to see how the inauguration goes. Certainly does feel like trepidation rather than celebration, in very strict contrast to 2008. But I have a theory, and I may have egg on my face in a few months' time. I'm used to that after 2016. But I have a theory that, you know, there will be some sort of military action against ISIS, not sooner rather than later, which may mean that Trump's approval ratings that are on, you know, in the doldrums right now, may not be in the doldrums forever. But I guess the proof of that remains to be seen. The biggest issue, though, for Democrats is how they get back control of Congress, which doesn't seem to be an easy job in 2 years' time, given the seats that are up and their inbuilt disadvantage in the House, and also who they put up in 2020. I have this sort of image of Elizabeth Warren losing to Donald Trump in 4 years' time, but I guess we will see what happens. Certainly, if his approval rating does remain in the 30s and 40s, he's going to face a tough challenge, but then US presidents tend to get re-elected, don't they? But anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's podcast. A big thanks to my guest earlier, Adam Drummond, and of course, JC Buer, as I've just mentioned. If you like what you hear, do like our Facebook page, do share the podcast on social media. It helps get our sort of name out there. And if you have iTunes, do subscribe and give us hopefully a nice comment and a nice rating. Everything like that does help share the podcast and grow our audience. We don't make any money out of this, so it's really good to grow our audience and like I say, get our voice out there. Stay tuned for more episodes in the coming weeks, where we'll be looking at the Brexit debate in more detail, but also trying to delve into some of the issues too. And we should have an exciting announcement about Polling Matters in the near future as well, so do stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, thanks for listening.